Hello and welcome back to Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. I'm your host, Josh Campbell. Render Unto Caesar seeks to explore the connection between religion and the public sphere. The title comes from one of the more well-known events in Jesus' life, when he gets asked if a devout Jew should pay taxes to Rome. Jesus says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's." Today's show is the last part of a three-part series with former U.S. soldier Stan Goff. In the past two shows, Stan has talked with us about his extensive military career, his conversion to Christianity, and his writings. Today, Stan talks about the importance of a conspiracy of friendship, in which he challenges woke folks to build bridges and open lines of communication. He mentions the Green New Deal and how state socialism is only a temporary fix for a long-term plan that revolves around small-scale solutions and incarnational support systems. Thanks for listening. I'm curious, Stan, with, you know, taxing the rich, I mean, I'm with you. I hear you. I'm just curious, how do you, like I was watching a film by Robert Reich, I think it was, the one, it was just talking about, I can't remember the name of it. It was excellent. It was about the American economy. And at one point he was an economist who worked for Clinton and then kind of got released because he was, you know, his reforms were a bit too radical. But anyways, at one point in the film, he goes to visit, you know, some blue collar workers in some kind of mill. And they talk about that. He talks about this idea of taxing the rich. And, you know, these guys don't want to do it. As much as they're being screwed over by the upper class, they don't want to do it because of this mythology that, you know, people need to be able, we need to be free of constraints. And yeah. I mean, how do you tackle that kind of mythology?
I can't think of who it was. It might have been Belloc or Chesterton. Or I don't know who it is. Someone said something about every American who's not rich is dreaming about the day that he's going to be rich. You know what I mean? Everybody thinks that, you know, you got to keep the door open because I might walk through the magic door one of these days and be rich myself. And yeah, you know, it's been a very successful, the propaganda on behalf of no restraint has been very successful. We associate it with freedom. I mean, that's not to say things like that can't change. I'll bet you there's fewer of them now saying that from the word. Interestingly enough, a good number of Trump's base would have been completely down with that. And in fact, there was a 10% shared base between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And I saw that here in Michigan. Because people aren't all news junkies. They got to do stuff like wash their clothes and, you know what I mean, run around, chase the kids and all that. They don't. Everybody's not some kind of political junkie keeping up with all this stuff. They hear this guy come up here and spout this populist rhetoric. But, you know, we're going to go after Wall Street. And it's like, oh, hell yeah, we're going to go get them. then what they do is they commit to a brand and then they become, you know, defenders of the brand, which is this sort of psychological drift that people go through, gets them hooked into a cult like Trump had. But I think it'd be better now. One thing, my late friend Mark Jones, who was probably the most consistent communist that I've ever known, and he'd spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union. In fact, they locked him up in the Soviet Union one time. He forgave him and they let him out, but he spent a night in the Lubyanka and all that. What was I going to say about Mark? What were we just talking about? Man, I'm getting old. he was talking about the Russian Revolution. And he said, you know, people look at, and this was back in the 90s when, you know, socialism was like a couple of study groups and everybody else was against it. And the money was flowing like crazy from that speculative bubble. You know, and everybody was just like on this consumer bacchanalia. But he pointed out that 2 years before the Bolshevik Revolution, the same peasants that were cheering in the Bolshevik Revolution were throwing their hats in the air to go fight the Kaiser. So things come along and change people. I think this pandemic has changed a lot of people, and it's going to change a lot more. So the trick is to have your message, keep your message out there, keep your message consistent, keep putting in front of people so they can counter it on their own terms. And eventually circumstances will bring them over to your side of the board. Because we're not done yet. I think maybe a lot of Republicans are like going, because they don't want to be held responsible for what comes next. And nobody really knows what comes next. But right now we're killing 4,000 people a day with COVID right now. Our economy is in a tatters. Retail economy is in a tatters. The local Cineplex is closed down. All the restaurants here are gone broke. So this cascade effect that's coming from this is exacerbating the situation generally while this financial bubble grows. And it's not going to be long before we see the next liquidation of assets. And that's going to hit a lot of people in the ways that they're only tangentially involved in bond markets and things like that, but in their 401ks and all this other stuff. And once again, there's going to be less money that's out there floating around. That's expendable income. So yeah, we're looking at a lot of big problems coming down the pike. And that's going to change people's consciousness. So, I don't know. But who am I to say? My own take is we need to keep saying the same things. Basically, we need to keep the same things that Bernie Sanders is saying and say them again and again and again and again and again. Because it's Medicare for all, federal jobs guarantee, Green New Deal. Medicare for all, federal jobs guarantee, Green New Deal. Pound that stuff home, help people understand it, and when they confront something in their own life to which it pertains, then, well, no. Federal jobs guarantee, a lot of people are going to be up for that. If they say, we're going to create 20 million new jobs, it's like, oh, hell yeah, let me get on board. And by the way, they're going to be $15 an hour, and you're going to be able to join a union.
Yeah. I feel like just on those, if I can stop you there, Stan, on those three things you mentioned that, you know, federal jobs guarantee, healthcare, and what was the other thing? Sorry?
Green New Deal.
Yeah, the Green New Deal.
The Green New Deal is kind of the federal jobs program.
Right. Yeah. There seems to be two ways that maybe more extremists are interpreting that. And I'd like you to speak to this. One is it's leading to a Soviet style socialism, and the other side is, these people like AOC, Bernie Sanders, the stuff you're talking about, they're in league with Soros and Schwab and Bill Gates with this global reset that's just going to line the pockets of elites. I find that interesting that, you know, I mean, from my perspective, that those three things don't equate to either of those poles. But why do you think people are going to these kind of extremes when they hear those three things you're talking about?
It's their indoctrination. But people will question their indoctrination as new circumstances arise in their own lives. And I can't control how people think. I certainly have no way to respond to these kind of things that are completely irrational. You can chip away at that, you know, one person at a time or whatever. I really do think that.
I mean, I see this worldview.
Needs to learn to be a pole of attraction.
Yeah.
And that's why I have a real issue with people like wanting to dump on Trump supporters. You know, Trump's gone. Why dump on his supporters? Well, you know, that's an easy thing to do, and it's very ego satisfying for some people because they can find somebody that they think less of than themselves. It's classist as hell. It's an overgeneralization. You know, we need to become a pole of attraction, and we don't do that by calling people stupid because they didn't understand. Because I was the same kind of stupid once upon a time myself, and we have to allow for that. I'm 70 years old, and I'm still finding that I was stupid 2 years ago. So you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess just to make it more specific to this topic, Stan, is I'm troubled by that viewpoint that takes it to either of those extremes that's within Christianity itself, you know, yeah. Not to the general public necessarily, but it's just, I'll give you an example. I had a family member who shared with me a video from one of the doctors that's on the American frontline doctors, basically who's challenging vaccinations and COVID stuff. And the video she sends me is this doctor gets up in a church and people are cheering in the church and she's given a platform there. The next week you see her at the Capitol siege with a megaphone. And I was in this conversation with my family member. They're saying, well, you know, you need to watch this. This is important. And my comment to her was, why aren't U.S. Christians sitting in churches demanding health care for millions of people that don't have it? That's the serious problem, not this conspiracy that, you know, I don't know. I get very frustrated with that. And I know you're right that I was in the same mindset years ago.
Oh, it's easy to do. It's easier to get mad at someone than it is to make friends. And one of the things that I don't know, was it Mammoth Ecology where I talked about conspiracy of friendship? I get that from Illich. I think that's, from a Christian perspective, that's the most important thing we can do is be friends to people. And just in terms of, from a strictly like political tactical sense, I'd be delighted if we just quit punching down. And cracking on Trump supporters is punching down. You go to punch. If you feel like you got to punch somebody, punch up. Don't be punching down on people just because they don't know any better, just because they're desperate, because they're scared, because they're still processing the indoctrination that every single one of us went through. And we don't know anything about any of these people's individual circumstances. And for that matter, again, you know, going back to the, you know, the little peasants who threw their hat in the air to go fight the Kaiser, and then they came back and almost starved to death. Right now, we're watching that whole thing begin to break up. And there's a lot of things going on. The nationalistic, the so-called Christian right in the United States has a specific genealogy, not far from where I come from down in Arkansas. It's actually Arkansas, Texas, and Oklahoma or Louisiana. Texarkana is like the birthplace of this stuff. Then it went out and it was nurtured in a hothouse in Southern California. And that's what pushed Reagan and Reaganism into the mainstream. And then it became, you know, an industry. They've gone way out on a limb now. We didn't saw the limb off. And one thing that we're seeing right now, just days after Trump left, is without their titular head, that whole thing is beginning to break up. So you've got some people kind of calving off into the right wing of the Democratic Party right now. You got some people kind of calving off into the they're starting to see a little bit of repentance on the part of some evangelicals. You've seen a lot of people that just had to turn their back on like the QAnon lunatics and all that after this putsch attempt in DC a couple weeks ago. So that coalition is beginning to break down. And then you got the libertarians who were never particularly Christian. In fact, most of the libertarians are atheists. They're like Ayn Rand acolytes, and they're kind of going off in their own way. So there's a lot of people that are going to be out there with some damage to their sense of belonging. That's what we all really want. We want to belong to something, you know. That's why I say the pole of attraction means the left has to become attractive to people, not through ideological constructs, because we're sitting around trying to convince people who don't like to read, and everybody doesn't have to like to read, to like all the things and do all the things and think the ways of people who do a lot of reading. That's elitist as hell. You know what I mean? We need to make friends with people and give them a place where they feel like they can belong without feeling threatened by it, because they went into these groups because they lack a sense of belonging. And it only got worse with the pandemic and the social isolation. We've all come to rely on this, you know, right here, this data stream to stay in contact with other human beings. And it's not terribly satisfying. It doesn't take the place of human face-to-face relationships. It doesn't take the place. I mean, we can talk together, but there's a lot of things we can't do together. We can't work on a garden together. We can't go build something together. We can't go visit somebody in the hospital together. We can't do any of that stuff. You know, and so that's put people's sense of belonging in a kind of crisis. And it's made it easier for all of us to sort of consolidate in our little tribes. And ideology has been elevated where that personal contact has been denigrated. You know, getting out of the pandemic is going to be helpful. But again, with the multiple crises that we're facing as we move further into the future, if we want to win people over, whoever the we is, you can't do it by saying, you know, you suck and I'm smarter than you. That's never worked for me in making friends with anyone. But it's out there. It's out there. And it's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was one thing I wanted you to chat about, Stan, was you mentioned, I mean, I summed it up as the impersonable socialist state, and how this can often be a problem on the left. Oh, is God. Could you comment on that? You know, like, just, you mentioned that, you know, yeah, we need the state to take more control in a short term, but we shouldn't look to the state to fulfill that kind of incarnational person to person. I don't know if you know what I'm getting at there.
Yeah. I would like to see the state used as the only accountable body on the scale that's necessary to create the conditions that facilitate the conspiracies of friendship. But you got to have time and you got to have energy. I mean, you know, when a lot of people, Audre Lorde wrote an essay years and years ago called The Uses of the Erotic, and everybody thought it was something about sex. It had nothing to do with sex. When she was talking about erotic, she was talking about something like Marcuse would talk about, cathexis. It's about this psychic spiritual connection we have with other people and other and with the world. And in that, she said, you know, everybody has a finite amount of energy. You know, I use energy to sit here and talk on this machine. I use energy to go wash the dishes. I use energy to go out and walk the dog. I use energy when I go to work, and it's finite. It becomes even more finite if we're all desperately trying to survive, you know, in this kind of Hobbesian war of all against all. If the state, as the only accountable body on the scale necessary to get the job done, can create the conditions where we have more time and more space to do things with more people, then a lot of this will help solve itself. I mean, look, capitalism was never about the market working on its own. They've always had to control the market. Capitalism couldn't even come into existence and take off the way that it had to do without enclosure. It had to throw people physically off the land and force them into a state of dependency. So it's reducing that state of dependency and giving people more time. so that we're not all on a treadmill just trying to survive the next day or the next week or the next month or the next year. That then people will have the time and the relationships that are necessary to begin to do this subsidiary thing where we solve our problems at the lowest possible level. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that. I'm not a distributist per se, but I do agree that there's, in this notion of subsidiarity, is always solve the problem on the lowest level. I mean, that's kind of, you know, that's kind of biblical too.
Right.
Yeah. See, mm-hmm. you know, the first one is if somebody is like screwing up, send one person over to talk to them. If that don't work, then you send a few people over to talk to them. You know what I mean? Get it done as simply and directly as possible. And if that doesn't work, then go to the next level. But we can't get down to the level when everything's being administered from the upper level. I'm watching this guy, Mark Blythe, who's a social democratic economist. That he's quite good, and he's a gifted speaker, kind of extemporaneous speaker. But he was talking about oh shit! Now I lost the rabbit again. What were we just talking about, Mark? Subsidiarity.
Yes.
Oh, about everything being administered from the top. One of the things, and I didn't know this until I heard him, the 2008 financial crisis comes along. And I mean, I complained, as did a lot of other people, that all the money went straight into the banks, you know, went straight into the financial sector. But Mark Blythe kind of explained, he said they really didn't have any choice. Because he described it, he says it's a system of pipes. So you've got the Fed with the money, and it's got pipes, the established pipes. They have established relationships and established procedures and policies to work with the financial sector. So they've got pipes to the financial sector. They did not have any pipes to local governments. They didn't have any pipes to local businesses. They didn't have any pipes going anywhere else. You see what I'm saying? So everything... all the money that had to go in had to be pushed in through the only pipes that they had and then trust them to do the right thing with it, which, of course, they didn't. They turned around and held on to it. But he said, you know, the problem is that we don't have those pipes established right now. And that's kind of the problem with, you know, he's describing a vice of scale on its own. Scale by itself creates all sorts of problems. I kind of go back to Robin Dunbar on this. And Robin Dunbar was a sociologist, I think, but he did some studies and he figured out that the maximum number of like I-thou intensity relationships that we can sustain as an individual human being, he gave it 150. I don't know how in the world anybody maintains 150 friendships. I have a hard time maintaining 5, you know what I mean? But he says a 150 is kind of the max. And I immediately identified that with that because that's about the size of a rifle company in the military. And so, and I realized that, you know, my day-to-day life in a rifle company was with about 150 guys, and I knew them all well enough, and we all worked together well enough. Beyond that, people can't sustain them because they don't have the time, the energy, or the sort of wiring wherewithal to keep up with all that. And you know, it occurs to me that anything bigger than 150, what it requires just for accomplishing projects and conflict resolution and all that, then you have to have, beyond a certain point, you have to have a layer of administration and management to take care of all that. But there's a natural tendency on the part of administration and management to pull power up into themselves and then put themselves over, as opposed to supporting all these people. They go from being administrators to managers very quickly. And that kind of describes the problem of scale, is that the further you go up these hierarchies, the further, the greater the scale, the less the solution can match the problem.
Right.
The less capacity that body has to address the more granular problem. And so that's why I believe in this notion of subsidiarity. And then if you're going to do things on a large scale, do things on a large scale that require a large scale. Right. You know, Social Security is a very good example. Social Security is a wonderful program. It's the reason that I'm not having to go take a job at Walmart right now, you know, as a septuagenarian.
Stan, I just want to wrap up here. I got one or two more questions. The next one, I noticed
you off on these tangents.
No, it's fine. It's great. You touched on in your book, Mammon's Ecology, you touched on this idea of the commons a couple of times. And I was thinking about this. I took my daughter. She's really into hockey and skating, and she wants to go to the outdoor rink. Obviously there's no organized hockey right now, so because of COVID, but I notice when I go to that rink, which is free, it's just, you know, upkeep by the neighborhood. I think the city, my city, pays for that infrastructure. I notice a lot of the people that are there are people who probably can't access organized hockey done in buildings. And it just, I have such a good feeling when I'm there with my daughter and all these other people there, and we're enjoying it. And it made me think, like, you know, and I can't remember where I read this, but if we had many more things as common domain, and just, you know, we had a lot of nice things that were in the common domain rather than just as individuals privately having nice things as common domain, you know, that's where my mind went when I was reading some of your stuff. Yeah. I wonder if I'm accurate.
I live right next door to our public pool here. And the pandemic obviously put a quietus on that this year, but we've took our grandkids come to visit in the summer. We take them down there. I love going to that public pool. I love going to the public pool, and I'm not too big on swimming. I'm a very good swimmer. I'm just jumping in the water and swimming around. And yeah, I kind of end up, you know, lay in the shade somewhere kind of mode, but I love going down there and just watching people because, like you say, they're coming from many walks of life. And they've got this common area. And in particular, if you watch the children go out there and make friends like that. I mean, right away. Our grandson, one grandson came down here. And this is a very white town here. We're about one out of five Latino and the rest white, and maybe, 3% black, something like that. And our grandson's black. He came down here and went to the pool. Within a week, he had his own little posse down there. You know what I mean? And he came back the next year and knew all the same kids again. You watch those kids go down there, and they've got a place, like you say, like the hockey rink. They're going to be around people doing the same thing that they like to do that they wouldn't be around otherwise. And it turns out that they make friends very easily. And it's a beautiful thing to watch.
That wraps up another edition of Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. During these last three episodes, we've heard from former Delta Force soldier Stan Goff. There are two things that will stick with me from my interview with Stan. One was him telling Lowe's hardware store workers not to thank him for his military service because, and I quote, "I just make war on poor people," end quote. The other was Stan's criticism of an educated left that just punched down on people like Trump supporters. In an age of conspiracy theories and fake news, I think that all of us could make the world a great deal better if we chose to listen more and understand where others are coming from. Join us next time on Render Unto Caesar as we hear from Dr. Bridget Kahl, a German biblical scholar who unpacks the life of the Apostle Paul. She claims that new insights into his life and writings may reveal just how much the greatest Christian missionary has been misunderstood. And here's a spoiler. His message may have been a lot more political than we think. Thanks for listening.